This is The Conversation. It's episode 198 with Jimmy Dams. He is a New York, Manhattan specifically based gallerist behind Envoy Enterprises. I, like perhaps some of you, if you are readers of Hyperallergic Art News and so on, saw a letter to Jimmy's list about his frustrations with the art world and why he was changing the model of the gallery to become an event space as opposed to an assembly line space. I read that. We reached out to Jimmy, and thankfully, he agreed to come on the show and indeed turned out to be a very thought-provoking, provocative-speaking, art-world-trashing, if you will, guest. Great to talk to, and I think you will enjoy and be thought-provoked. I'm Michael Shaw. I'm the website for this podcast, where I highly recommend you go for several reasons, is theconversationpod.com. You can see the letter, which Jimmy will read at the beginning of the show, but you can read alongside in case you miss anything on the art news page, which is linked on theconversationpod.com. You can also see images of Jimmy and his artists, one of his collectors, a very rogue and intriguing and definitely independent bunch, as we talk about quite at length. So please go check those out. And by the way, being on the website for a couple of minutes every now and then does help, gives us better Google Analytics and so on. So yes, you can definitely, and I am thankful that you consume this podcast in audio form, in pod form, but every once in a while, go check out the website, peruse it, have a look around, let's get this out of the way in case you bail at the end. Donate to the show. It's been a while. When the Patreon donations are downgraded or people leave Patreon, we need people to fill those spaces. So maybe that can be you. That's all at theconversationpod.com, both donating to the show via Patreon on an ongoing basis or one-time donation via PayPal are both there. Thank you in advance for that. So, yes, a very intense and enjoyable. And one other thing that I'll say about it, and this ties into what I'm going to be talking about on the back end, which is a letter from Kerry James Marshall that's included in the catalog that went along with his recent show, or perhaps still ongoing show. And the thing that I want to say is that I know that some of you are in grad school or maybe just out. But I like to think that most of the listeners who are artists are working artists or, artists who have been out in the world for a while. But I will say that I do feel like sometimes the way that I ask questions is tailored towards people in grad school. And certainly that's the case at one point here, particularly because Jimmy talks about his experiences going to an art school in New York and the astonishment that he experienced with what happened. So we will talk, you will hear all about that. And yes, on the back end, I'm going to read from that Kerry James Marshall letter. So if you're not familiar, please do stay tuned for that. I actually found out about that part of the whole thing from another podcast, not an art podcast, a comedy podcast, actually. That's also very arts and liberal friendly. So that's where I heard about it. And I was like, wow, this is intense stuff. So I'm going to share that with you on the back end. I think that's about it. I hope you guys are well. I know it seems like it's been a while since last episode, hasn't it? Even though it was just 2 weeks ago. Maybe it's something about the summer. Maybe it's the fact that I was out of town for pretty much three consecutive weekends, which is incredibly rare for me. And now having been in an airport, essentially for three trips back and forth in less than a month, I'm not going to be going to LAX, I hope, again, ever, if I can help it. So anyway, that's enough of that. Let's get into that conversation with Jimmy of Envoy Enterprises. And thank you very much for being here. I will talk to you more on that back end. Okay, so let me just set this up real quick, or maybe you can. This was an email that went out to your email list, the gallery's email list, is that right?
Yes.
And that was back in sometime in June?
Yeah, that was the 21st of June.
Okay, great. So would you like to read it for us? Starting with dear.
Yes. dear friends, as of August 4th, Envoy Enterprises will close its gallery space. While we will continue to exist, the time has come to take a step back and change the formula. The reason for my decision is simple. It's not fun anymore. In my opinion, the art industry has developed into an uninteresting, boring entity. I have no interest in mimicking innovation. I have no interest in any kind of short-termism. And I do not wish to be a part of an art industry in which a four-leaf clover gets stripped of its extra leaf to make it fit into the standard idea of a clover. I have no interest in being part of an art industry where eyes have been replaced by dollar signs, an eagerness to experience and learn replaced by hiring personal shoppers, and ambition, which once used to push the quality of art, reduced to a hunger for being listed in whatever top 10 du jour. On top of that, I find the continuous focus on art fairs incomprehensible and its vulgarity staggering. Is there really anyone out there who believes people visit art fairs from a desire to improve their perceptions? We should be improving people's lives through art. We should be trying to create a world where art is living on every level, indivisible from life and for everyone to experience. Art should be about an attitude and about not being frightened of being thought of as uncool. It should be the antithesis of consumerism and aesthetic corruption that rules the art world. It should be about the idealization and aestheticization of daily life, as opposed to guarding so-called critical high standards within the increasingly static art establishment and its ridiculous hierarchy. It should be, but it is not. Thank you to everyone who supported EE over the years. I appreciate your loyalty and love more than you can imagine. I wish all of you a lot of kindness and a wonderful summer. Jimmy Dams.
Great. Thank you for reading that. We could really analyze various parts of that, and maybe we will as the conversation goes on. But just to maybe give people a little context, including me, first, you closed the doors. It's now August 16th. You closed the doors like a week and a half ago, something like that, two weeks ago? Yeah.
Yes.
And when I called you just now, you said you were really busy. So what, first of all, what are you busy doing?
Well, as I stated in the letter, Envoy Enterprises continues to exist. What we closed is the gallery space, meaning the space where we did our assembly line exhibitions, which is what I call them, where you do exhibitions every 5 weeks and you basically have no time whatsoever then spend all of your attention on the exhibition that is up for those 5 weeks. And your attention also goes during that time to the exhibition coming up for the next 5 weeks. So it's literally an assembly line thing. That plus, aside from that, it serves no function. And I have opened another space, which is an event space, which is called Envoy Enterprises Event Space, and which is two floors and is in Bushwick. And it basically has exhibitions up for 4 months. And it's only open when there is an event or by appointment. And so that's why I'm busy, because I'm in the middle of...
You're in the middle of...
Of putting up an exhibition up in that space.
Got it. Okay. Okay, well, that's interesting. I think, for me, I think one of the emotional resonances of the letter feels a little bit like you're getting out of the art world. And I should tell you or remind you, I should say, and listeners who are not familiar, that about 4 years ago, I spoke with your compatriot, Nicole Klagsbrunn, who is a fellow Belgian, moved to New York, and herself closed her gallery for not dissimilar reasons right back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume she's kind of doing similar things too. She's still working within the art world as you are.
Right.
So I guess maybe the question is, how much of you, in relation to some of the things you wrote in that letter, feel like, I actually just kind of want to get out of this whole thing altogether?
Let's say 80%.
Right.
Because the what I'm doing right now, to me personally, I consider that as something different.
Mm-hmm.
It's the arts, and I'm still working for and with the artists,
mm-hmm.
but we're more of a commune than we are anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And the gallery world, as it exists with its art fairs and its hierarchy, is of absolutely no interest to me, because it's just, as they say in France, they put petit bourgeois. And that never moves things along or makes things change. It's just a static thing, and I'm not interested in that.
Yeah. Is one way, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, so definitely correct me if I'm off, but is one way of paraphrasing what you just said that the contemporary art world, the market art world that you're referring to, has become this place where very saleable, predictable, boring even objects are being churned out and sold in galleries and art fairs, and this is a petit bourgeoisie, or what have you, however you want to put it again, this is not what you signed up for. And it seems to
be
what the art market has turned into.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Completely.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Of course, there was always a sales aspect, but there is a big difference with wanting to sell an artist's work and basically turning into a corporation.
Right.
And I always give an example. When the art market crashed in the early 90s, collectors would go to the East Village art scene in New York and buy from really young galleries and buy artists they never even heard of, but bought their work. And they basically fed a lot of artists and fed a lot of galleries. And if they were interested solely out of an investment point of view, they still made a killing, because out of the, let's say, 20 artists they bought, at least two of them would make it really big, and they had their money. And an example of that is Elaine Danizer. Elaine Danizer, whose collection is at MoMA, she was one of these people who stepped over bodies to get into a gallery to go and buy art.
Mm-hmm.
What has changed now is, after the Great Recession, everyone is buying art at its highest value. And I keep asking people who are in the finance industry, and I tell them, like, do you own a Damien Hirst? Yes. Did you pay more than $50,000 for it? Yes. Huh. Well, do you buy stock at its highest price? No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, may I then ask why you buy art at its highest value? Because it does not make any sense to me. And I know why it is. They don't go to art galleries. They send personal shoppers to go and buy them something.
Mm-hmm.
And the personal shoppers, of course, are not going to go to a gallery where there is a painting of $1,500, because then they make $150.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't pay for their Prada shoes. So why would they do that?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that's where everything is going wrong, and keeps going wrong more and more and more. And I'm convinced that the blue chip galleries that will remain will basically turn into Saks Fifth Avenue or Bergdorf Goodman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a brand, and then you have some luxury articles, and that's it. And of course, they will contest that, and they will say, well, we're still showing art that's really important and that's really interesting. I'm not saying that everything they show is utterly boring and uninteresting, but I am saying that it is a capitalist investment, and it's nothing else but that.
Mm-hmm. Were there a couple of moments along the way for you, say in the last year, or if not, you know, 5 years or more even, where you could see them as turning points in your attitude or disappointment with the art world?
It started changing right before the recession. I felt sales were all of a sudden dropping. The recession hadn't happened yet, but the sales were dropping.
Mm-hmm.
And shows that usually would sell out all of a sudden didn't sell anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was strange. I never cared putting up shows that didn't sell. I thought it was, I would love for the artist to make money, but I didn't care losing money by putting up shows.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that the artist had to show what they wanted to show, whether it sold or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, but during the recession, all of a sudden, of course, everything fell flat. Nothing sold, and a whole bunch of galleries closed. I didn't close because I thought, well, we need to do something because not, there's so many artists out there that have no place to go right now because no gallery will take them in because you're a risk. You're not going to bring in any money. You're not a big name. So, no, all the galleries basically closed their doors to emerging artists.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to start a one day at a time program. I had a big gallery space, which I split into on the one side. I kept my exhibitions as they were scheduled. And in the other space, I did a different show every single day. So an artist would come in at 7 in the morning, hang the show. The opening would be in the evening at 6. Next morning, they would come and take it down while the other artists would come in and put their show up. And I would do them like every single day, months on end. And that basically put us through the recession.
Wow.
Plus, it gave these artists a chance to show their work. And, you know, everyone had to show up because normally in New York you can say, I'm sorry I couldn't make it to your show because this and this, and I had to go there and there. Now there's only one day, so you had to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And so people showed up, and people came out, and people were happy because they were doing something creative, and they were having their work shown. And so, you know, the dark cloud of the recession did not hang over us.
How were the sales during those one day shows?
They would sell, yes, because they were cheap.
Mm-hmm.
The work was really, really cheap.
Right.
So it would sell. There were a number that did not sell, but sold afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
I also had about 3 artists that I kept from those one day at a time shows, and that I started representing because I thought the work was great and the people were great. So it was a very interesting and very satisfying thing. Until one of the curators of a show took advantage of the situation, and that was the end of the one at a daytime shows. And that was also the beginning where I started feeling not so happy about the art world. And from that moment on, it only grew. And it grew and it grew. And I talked to colleagues, and we shared the same opinions. And you really care for your artists as a dealer. You're supposed to. So it is difficult to make the decision to say, listen, I'm going to close the space and I'm going to do something else. And you can still show with me and we can still work together. But I'm no longer going to be playing the game of being in the art world as people see it.
Can we go back to that moment? Because I think I'm a little hazy on the details there. Maybe you can flesh mm-hmm. them out a little bit. So you're doing the one-a-day shows, and you said for months
right.
on end, right? So you did several months during the recession of shows that last of an artist or a group of artists that somebody curated
yes.
that lasted... That basically you had the opening in the evening and then it was done by the morning.
Right.
So what exactly happened with this one curator? Walk me through that if you would.
The reason we made money during those shows was A, because we would sell the art piece, but also B, because there was a bar below in the basement or the back of the gallery. And we worked together, and they agreed that you send people down to the bar, and we got a share from the bar.
Mm-hmm.
So that made us money. So everyone knew you do not bring your own booths. We want to keep this program going, So you want a drink, that's fine. The drinks are downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And those drinks were like $3. I mean, please.
Right.
They were not $12 cocktails.
Right.
So, and everyone, you know, did that. Everyone is fine. Until that particular curator told this girl, you should go and pick up the wine. And I said to the girl, you know, you remember, right, what the statement said? You cannot bring wine in because we are all in downstairs, and you can get wine downstairs, and it's cheap, it's fine. Oh, yeah, I know. Sure enough, come 6 o'clock, she comes in dragging several bags of wine. And I said, no, those bottles of wine need to go. You can't do that because that's not the deal. Oh, yeah, okay, I'm sorry. So the show is going on, and there was a separate room with a video in it. And by that time, in the other space, I had put Feature, which was a gallery here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically sat there while they were thinking what they were going to do. So Hudson of Feature had his offices there. And in between his office and the video space and the gallery where I was sitting, that I couldn't see who was sitting in front of the video because it was behind the wall. Now, I saw people, and I was working, so I see people come in, but I didn't see anyone come out. And at one point, I felt like, wait a minute, there's been quite a few people coming in, and I haven't seen passing anyone go by my desk. And so I felt like, I'm going to pay attention to the next one that comes in. So the next one comes in, also goes to the back to the video space, and I wait, doesn't come back. So I get up and go and look, and sure enough, they were all sitting in Feature's office, sitting on artwork, it was incredible, and drinking booze.
Wow.
That they had brought themselves.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, and I lost it. And I said, get out, everyone out. You just killed the program that benefited so many people. And I said, and you are responsible for that because you are now the reason that I'm not going to do it anymore.
Well, first of all, let me jump in, Jimmy. So first of all, I love the way that you brought in the suspense to that story. It felt like a little mini murder mystery.
it was.
But secondly, the other thing, other than enjoying that aspect of it, it's really, we have to sort of maybe see if we can figure out if this curator who was so stubborn in sort of doing their own thing is a symptom, you know, of, I don't know, some kind of entitlement, of selfishness, of, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to do my own
of
thing.
Course.
And how do you think that is a symbol of the things that are wrong with the art world that you described earlier?
That's been going on for a while, but usually you have a sort of an antenna and you feel them coming and you just steer away from them.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, you know, the antenna isn't strong enough and then, yeah, well, then you have what I had. But there are more and more of those. And of course, because within a system where the bourgeoisie is basically running the show, that those are the people you're getting. And that means their children are curators. They are art advisors. You know, those are children from the bourgeoisie. So, and they work in the same social circles and us knows us. And like bees, they go from one money flower to another money flower.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're like that little flower, like right next to it, they're not interested. They're just flying from their own family flower to the other family flower.
Right. So in other words, this particular curator, as an example, is somebody mm-hmm. that is probably both protected trust fund wise and
yes.
maybe also socially has some
yes.
kind of social protection that they can get away with that kind of behavior.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's exactly like that. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's really sad.
which I found out later on because I then like Googled the name of the person because I was like, who is this person?
Mm-hmm.
And then it all came. I was like, I should have Googled this person before. But I mean, the whole Googling thing, I think, is also so obnoxious.
Yeah.
Like, I want to deal with people. I don't want to make a register of who comes in and out of the space. So, but in retrospect, I did it because I needed to know, who is this horrible person?
Yeah.
And where did this person come from, and how can you be like that? I mean, mm-hmm, really, mm-hmm. I didn't get it. Mind you, I also had artists that are like that.
Sure.
No one is, and they're dealers like that. So no one escapes this sort of entitlement and this, well, to me, incomprehensible behavior. I really don't know what to do with it because I'm just baffled by it.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you're describing that situation and that type of rogue sort of behavior, I was thinking that there's this odd paradox that, and I'm sure you've heard this too. Correct me if you haven't. But you hear about people who work in blue chip galleries, say, you know, who we're kind of talking about as being this sort of empire of the art world that, you know, is not going to go away and is undefeatable. But you hear about a number of the curators, directors, et cetera, who work in these galleries as being very quintessentially professional. You know, and they wouldn't be able to, you know, maintain these kinds of jobs and the kind of productivity that they do without being so. And I just wonder if we take that as to some degree true or partially true, or if not largely true, then how does your example sort of play out in that world? And the thing that comes to mind is I wonder if then the entitled people become the collectors. You know, so it's like the collectors become the people that fuck everything up for everybody.
Right. I chuckled with the word professionalism.
Okay.
Because because I really, what does that mean? Usually, when people tell me, "Oh, this or this is not professional," I just start laughing because I'm like, "What do you mean?" Because usually, what they mean is that you should do things a certain way. And the reason they bring that up is because they're incapable of doing it that way. And so they're projecting it onto other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always laugh when I hear professionalism, because then I also go like, if there is any profession where you really should not be professional, it's the art world, because it's about emotions. It's about feelings. It's about something that is supposed to be higher than an object for which you need professionalism to deal with. We all know we will put on our gloves when we handle a painting. But I don't call that professional. I call that logical.
Right.
So,
right.
Big difference here. So people should stop using that word, because that's literally connected to the corporate entities.
Mm-hmm.
Where, of course, if you're in a corporate entity, the only thing you hear is professional.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that word to me just, you know, I just chuckle. It's the same with the word successful. Also makes me chuckle. Successful, what does that mean? Well, I'll tell you what it means. It means money.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
if you're an artist who sells out an entire show, you are a successful artist.
Right.
Even though your art is basically total crap, well, you sold everything, so
yeah,
you're a successful artist.
Right, right.
And while I am showing Caravaggio paintings that were found in some dungeon in Rome and authenticated, and I'm selling them at the gallery and I don't sell them, well, I have a very unsuccessful show.
Right.
And this is an unsuccessful artist.
Right,
so
sure.
There is something seriously wrong with all these words. The successful, the professional, they should just drop them, because it basically all means money. And
mm-hmm.
if there is something I really don't want to talk about, it's money.
Right.
It makes me want to puke. It's just like, no, stop talking about money. I have to admit, when I came, I am originally from Europe. So 20 years ago, when I came to New York and the TV was on and they were talking about movies, and they said it was a Friday, and they said opening weekend, this movie made that $1 million. This movie made that many dollars.
Right.
And I was like, I was baffled. I'd never heard anything like that in my entire life. Because when in Europe they're talking about movies, they were talking about the movies and about the content of the movies, not about how much it makes. I mean, yeah. And I was really baffled. I was like, who cares how much this movie makes? I mean, yeah. Is this the point of, is this a topic? I mean, really?
It's a crap movie anyway. I said, and it's a crap movie anyway, because it's a Hollywood
yes,
movie.
Of course. That is, and then that's the only thing that it says is that definitely don't go and watch it.
Right.
So, and it's the same in the arts. Definitely don't go and buy it, because guess what? And I just I think it's sad that so many people with money are falling into this ginormous trap,
yeah.
And that no one seems to bother anymore about creating a personal collection of art which feeds them, not financially,
right,
but emotionally,
right. Sure.
which brings them joy, pleasure, or even scares them, whatever reason, but that enriches their lives, not financially.
Right.
I simply do not get it, and I refuse to get it, and I will keep refusing to get it.
Well, before
and
we,
they have an enemy. They have an enemy in me. So
okay,
I'm
well, we'll get to your enemy dynamic in a second, but I want, before we get too far away from it, I want to go back to the whole professionalism thing, because I want to push back just a little bit about that. I actually did not use the word professionalism. I just used the word professional, and
right.
I think while I get what you're saying about, you know, it should be emotional. It should not be corporate. That was sort of the gist of what you were saying. I think I don't think you can overestimate somebody acting professional, not as in professionalism, but professional. And what that essentially means, the way that I'm meaning it, is when they say they're going to do something by a certain time, they do.
Right.
That is not something you can underestimate. And it goes back to the example that you gave with that curator, because that curator said, oh, I'm not going to do that. But then they did do that thing that they said they were going to do.
Right.
So that's like the apotheosis, the opposite of being professional, right?
Yeah, right. That's correct. But that's where I would use the word logical instead of professional, because to me, it is logical. It is logical that when you are told this you do not do, and you agree to it, and you do it anyway, well, to me, that doesn't make any sense. It's illogical that you did that. And same way, like, it is professional to get back to someone at a certain time. Well, it's only logical to me that you do that, because it's downright rude if you don't.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't – it's semantics.
Yes.
I would never put the word professional to it.
Right.
Because there are a number of things that I assume are evident and logical.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand when they're put into question. Then I'm puzzled, because I'm like, well, this is the minimum of respect and the minimum of normal behavior. Do you really need to start spilling that out?
Yeah.
That's basically what I meant.
Sure. Yeah, I want to actually ask you about that concept when it comes to the artists that you work with over the years. But before I do, before I forget, I want to go back to the scenario, the program that you had where you had the daily openings, and then you had the bar downstairs, right, where people went to drink.
Mm-hmm.
Where was your gallery at that point when that was going on?
That was at 131 Christie Street.
Okay,
in Lower East Side.
Lower East Side, got it. Which has a lot of bars. So yeah. you got creative as a gallerist and as a business person to combine selling art with selling drinks, essentially, to kind of make your bottom line, right? So my question is, what have been maybe some of your other strategies that come to mind that you've done to sort of make ends meet over the 20 years that you've been doing this, other than the combining sales of art with getting people to drink down in the bar?
Oh, the only other thing is that I'm involved in the secondary market.
Okay, which is not unusual at all.
And so the secondary market basically pays for my overhead, which I'm more than happy to say, it's $50,000 a month. And that's a basic overhead that does not include insurance or shipping art. It basically just means the rent, the staff, and the phone and the internet. That's it.
Mm-hmm,
Everything else is extra cost. So even if I sell out a complete show of one of my artists, that doesn't pay the bill. So
sure. Gotta do
I have no choice but to start investing time and energy in the secondary market so that I could do shows that didn't sell, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And because there are artists who know, like, well, no one's going to buy my work, but I would love to show it. And I have no issue showing it because I'm not in it for the money. I just want to keep it going. And in order to keep it going, you have to figure something out of how. And during the recession, there was no secondary market. So it had to be something else.
Right.
So I came up with the idea. I spoke to the people downstairs who were also having a hard time. And I said, let's just stick our heads together and work this out together. And together we got through the recession. And so, but those are the only two things that I have to do in order to keep things going.
Right. One of the things that I like to try to do with this show, wherever possible, which is not necessarily often, is sort of get behind the back into the back room of the art world, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
since you were so forthcoming as to mention your bottom line, and I don't want to be gauche, but I'm just, if you feel up to it, would you feel comfortable breaking down any of that bottom line at all, or would you prefer not to? If so, I totally understand.
Breaking down the bottom line is in what is as in rent and staff expense.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, rent is about $24,000 a month.
Oh my God! And let's wait. Let's hang on that for a second. I just want to give that a moment to sink in. So this is your Lower East Side gallery, right?
Yes,
$24K a month. Okay, do you think that's pretty typical rent for the Lower East Side?
Yes. Yeah. This is cheap.
Wow.
Yes, because my landlord can actually ask at least $45,000 a month.
Wow. So here's a practical question before we get more into those bottom line numbers. What would it take? To let's say that this even occurred to you, let's say 5 years ago, what would it take to buy a place where your mortgage would be that much or less? Is that totally off the table?
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that answers my question, but I thought I would throw it out there anyway.
Well, for what I have at this moment, because I have two floors. So for what I have, that would be at least $8 to $10 million.
I see. Right. How many square feet are you getting for 24,000?
2,400.
Okay, so it's exactly 10,000 a square foot then, right?
Yes.
It's nice even number.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right. Okay. All right, so you're half of your bottom line is rent, roughly. So,
yes.
So we're talking about, I guess, you know, I don't want to be gauche. I don't want listeners to go, you know, stop, which I know some of the more sensitive ones are going to do, and fuck them. But I think the sort of subtext here is, despite all these challenges, are you making a comfortable living, would you say? however you want to answer that is fine.
am I making a comfortable living? No, not at all.
Okay.
Every day is a struggle.
Right.
Could I make comfortable living? Yes, if I just focused on the secondary market and did no shows whatsoever,
right,
and had no exhibition space, right, but just sat out of my apartment and did the secondary market, I'd be rich.
Right.
But and then what? Then I, what do I do with all that money? Just sit on it? No.
And so, how soon I would it kill your soul also, right?
Right. I want some purpose in my life.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
to me, this is it. I used to be an artist. I became ill, so I could no longer do my art. And so I had two options, go to a museum or start a gallery. Going to a museum is out of the question because I can't keep my mouth shut. So if I have something to say, I say it.
Uh-huh,
so
uh-huh.
That was immediately eliminated, and so that meant I had to start a gallery, and that's what I did.
Was this in Belgium before you moved to the States?
No, I was already in New York.
What happened? Tell us the story of you getting sick, if you don't mind.
That's a bit personal, but I came to New York in 1997, and it was a friend of mine, Hudson of Feature, mm-hmm, the gallery Feature here, mm-hmm, in New York, mm-hmm, who basically asked me to come over, and so, which is what I did, and I made my art. I was represented by Gracie Mansion here in New York for years, and so I basically lived off my artwork. Until 2005, when I was diagnosed, and then I could no longer use my hands for longer than 15 minutes, or it would, like, a nerve would get hit, and then it would be paralyzed, and blah 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
So, in order to stay in touch with the arts, Hudson said, "Open a gallery. That way, you can show people that you like and that you have an interest in." And he said, "It's what I did." He used to be an artist, and then he started the gallery.
Right.
And he said, "So do the same thing." And I said, "Yeah, but you know, you have to have capital, and I don't really know. You know, I'm an old socialist. I'm not a capitalist."
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And he was like, "Well, never mind. I'll help you for the first year." And he did. He financed the gallery for the first year.
Wow.
And after the first year, I was on both feet, so that was that. And I had the gallery for 12 years.
Wow. That's a really important part of your story, that you've only actually been in the gallery business for 12 years.
That's right.
Before that, you were doing art. Well, that's...
I was from 1984, I was an artist.
Wow. Okay. And just to give listeners a little bit more information about Feature. So Feature Gallery was a gallery that ran first in Soho, I believe, and then in Chelsea for a number of years, run by the formerly mentioned Hudson, the one, mm-hmm, single named Hudson, as far as I know.
Yes.
And who sadly died, I guess it has it already been like 10 years or not quite that long?
No. He died in 2014.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
And he opened his gallery in 1984 in Chicago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then he moved to Soho, at first to Broome Street, then to Green Street, and then to Chelsea, and then back here to the Lower East Side.
Okay, great. Thank you for clarifying that. And sorry, mm-hmm, that I was so off on when he passed. I don't know why I did that math in my head. But
well, you know, sometimes it seems like it has been 10 years. So.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I guess it's important to mention him because, like you, and it makes sense, being that he was a mentor, obviously, to you.
Right.
He was definitely not sort of part of that blue chip style of ethic. And yet,
correct,
he did represent a number of big name artists. In fact, I think one of the most memorable anecdotes that I can recall related to him is that for a number of years he represented the artist Tom Friedman, and then Tom Friedman's like, "I'm gonna cash out," and he moves to Gagosian, and I imagine there was a certain amount of bitterness there, right?
No, none.
Really?
Yeah. None.
Okay. Do you feel the same way if one of your artists cashes out like that?
I've never had anyone do that. Mm-hmm. What I did have people leave the gallery, but the circumstances in that case, they made me angry. Well, in the first place, extremely sad, and then angry, particularly because while I was running the gallery, we did what I call the pizza parties. So all the artists would come to the gallery, we would eat pizza, and we would all say what we had to say. So if an artist felt like, oh, you know, I feel that the gallery is not doing enough on this or that field, and we would talk about it. But the other artists would be there, so they would be stepping in and saying, yeah, but blah, blah, blah. And so in other words, it was a very nice way to run the gallery because everyone was involved. Mm-hmm. And all the chastising did not need to come from me. Sometimes the chastising would come from fellow artists. Mm-hmm. And I always said communication is key in every relationship, no mm-hmm. matter what relationship it is. Mm-hmm. So if there is something that bothers you, you say it, because if you don't say anything, I don't know it and I can't rectify it.
Right.
So to me, there was never a reason why anyone would leave the gallery, because you would talk to me
right.
before you left the gallery if you had something to say. Mm-hmm. And if you then up and left anyway, that was a slap in my face.
Right.
And I was never happy about it.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say, inevitably, there are just a number of types out there, particularly the shyest of artists who are just too chicken shit to bring their complaints directly to you, so it's easier for them to just bail.
Well, it's also, you know, they cite, oh, it's peer pressure and all that, and I'm like, you know, you need to make your decisions for yourself. You do not need to listen to, and definitely mm-hmm. don't ever, ever listen to another artist. Don't.
Uh-huh.
That is the main don't.
Right.
No matter how good friends you are,
right.
do not.
Mm-hmm.
And because as soon as you do that, well, then you're lost.
Right.
And also, the artists tend to forget as a gallery, we spent a lot of money in order to promote an artist's career. As I said, for example, when we do a show, that's already $50,000 right there that I'm spending so you can have a show.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're not even talking about the book we publish for you, which is like $20,000 to $25,000. I'm not talking about all the other things we're doing in order to promote you, and I'm not making one dime. And then to then leave and say, like, you know, you're not doing anything for me, that is, again, to me, so
wow.
mind-blowing.
Wow.
But it happens, mm-hmm. and it happens a lot.
Mm.
In my gallery, I think it happened with about four or five artists. I threw one out, and four left on their own accord. But all others stayed.
Let me, Jimmy, jump in with a quick question related to that. How much of that activity that you're describing, where despite all of your good graces and generosity as a gallerist, as a host to these artists, them leaving or complaining at the last minute or whatever, how much of that would you say informs the letter that you wrote and your frustration with the art world?
Well, it would be the minority, definitely, mm-hmm. because the artists are not all like that. But I would say the percentage of artists that are like that is about the same like galleries that are like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we always hear that galleries are the big evil. No, they're not the big evil. Some are, just like artists are. And they're about the same. It's about the same amount of evilness
mm-hmm.
coming from artists and dealers.
Mm-hmm.
So you
mm-hmm.
just need to pick and find the space where you feel at home. And that is what I did with all the dealers that I had in the past. I never had any problem with all my dealers. I had dealers in Amsterdam, I had dealers in Rotterdam, I had a dealer in Paris, I had a dealer in Brussels, in Ghent, here in New York. And I never, ever had words with any of them.
Mm-hmm.
never had any problems whatsoever.
Wow.
When I heard some of the stories that Hudson told me, I literally almost choked. Mm-hmm. When I heard Gracie Mansion telling me that stories of what happened to her, I almost choked.
Mm-hmm.
And those were all very good stories in the sense that I knew, like, oh, I really have to be careful as a dealer that that doesn't happen to me. Well, no matter how careful you are, believe me, it happens.
Right.
It's very difficult to keep it out.
Right.
And it doesn't make you happy. So.
Sure. One thing that I find really incredibly, actually, among all this content, I think one of the most interesting things is that you made such a sort of quick and successful transition from artist to gallerist. And I think a couple of things that I want to say about that. One is that it's pretty hard for me to imagine an artist turned gallerist that wouldn't maintain a certain amount of frustration at the art world through the rest of their career.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's
mm-hmm.
one point. But the other point is maybe more of a question, and that is, when you go from being an artist who's taking care of himself and his or her own vision, essentially, mm-hmm. right, to essentially becoming a minder, or there are a lot of synonyms or euphemisms that you
right.
could use, babysitter, maybe one of them,
right.
for a bunch of yeah. artists. I mean, that's a real paradigm shift. And I mean, did you have to put that particular perspective on what you were doing out of your head? In other words, if you thought, yeah, I'm going to be a gallerist and I'm going to babysit 15 artists, you know, throughout the course of a year,
mm-hmm.
you would kill yourself immediately, right? So you probably had to put that out of your mind. Is that about right?
Well, the way I saw it was that because I always say I was an artist, but of course, once an artist, always an artist.
Right.
So that means I saw them as fellow artists,
mm-hmm.
and I was just helping them with their careers,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. But as soon as I would come across someone who, you know, was like, you know, I need to be mothered or fathered or whatever, no, then I would immediately say, please, no, not for me, because that I cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
It's different when because I do have an artist who is really, like, you know, from the 19th century, so to speak, who lives in his studio, who smells of turpentine. It's difficult to get him out of the studio. He has completely no social behavior.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know how to behave socially.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's a true recluse, makes amazing paintings. And so he needs attention in the sense that I help him out, but I don't consider that as being a father to him or, like, you know, babysitting him, because he's his own person. I just facilitate things that he cannot do, which is basically what a gallery is meant to do. Because if people say, like, well, what is the purpose of galleries at this day and age? You can just put everything online and people buy it online and artists can run their own careers. Like, yes, there are artists have always been able to run their own careers when they were extroverts.
Right.
But there are also introverts.
Right.
And introverts cannot run their own career. What do they need? Someone to do it for them. And what was the norm? Well, when you went to a gallery and the gallery would do it for you. And that is a good thing, because I still believe that is a good thing, that you have someone who will do those things that you absolutely hate and don't want to do. Do that, they do it for you. And quite frankly, if I weigh throughout history, weigh extrovert artists towards introvert artists, well, the introvert artists tend to be the most interesting.
Mm. What was this guy, this painter's name again?
I didn't use his name.
Oh, are you able to or no?
I didn't, and I'm not going to use his name either,
okay.
because I don't want him to become known as a social awkward person.
Right, I understand.
You'll see it soon enough when you ever meet him.
Okay. But regarding this artist, before you came along, did he have another gallerist who was basically doing the same thing?
No,
how did he survive before that?
Well, he was actually presented to me by an artist of feature, and he brought him into the gallery and he said, you should look at this guy's work. And the guy just stood there. And so the artist of feature nudged him and he said, give him your slides. There were still slides back then.
Right.
Give him your slides. Come on, give him your slides. So then he handed me over a sheet of slides. And I very politely said, like, okay, I'm going to look at this, but I don't know how long it's going to take. It can be 2 to 3 weeks, just so you know, because I have a lot of things to do here. But I will definitely look and let you know. And so, and then they left. And while I walked to my office, I held the slides up to the light. And because I had a huge window in the gallery, because that was when the gallery was in Chelsea. And I held the slides up, and the phone number was on top of the slides. And as soon as I got into my office, I picked up the phone and I said, like, please bring me that and that painting.
Wow.
Because I was blown away by those paintings.
Wow.
And but, you know, he needed someone to bring him. He would never have come by himself, and he would just have painted and painted and painted, and that's it.
But I'm still curious, before he was with you, was he functional enough to have a day job to keep his painting?
No. No.
So he had some support.
His wife was the Brett winner.
I see. Got it. Okay. This introvert extrovert question or division is interesting as well. And being that you are an artist who is working with artists, as you put it,
right?
What would you say the breakdown is from your experience over your 40 years, as far as artists in the art world that you've encountered? I mean, it seems like percentage-wise, based on the world, that it would be roughly half and half, but it does kind of seem like that fine art tends to favor introverts a little bit more. Is that not true?
Well, things have been changing since art schools have started running business courses. I had to go and jury a show at a university here in New York, and it was for the master's degree. And literally every student offered me their business card before I even entered the studio.
Wow.
And they were taught to do that. So that to me is so wrong.
Yeah.
I cannot even explain how wrong that is.
Yeah.
And then when I saw the work and I did all of the students and I went up to the head of the department and I said, listen, you should just not take me, scrap me off the list of the jurors, and I wasn't here. And I said, because it doesn't reflect on you, but if I have to be honest, everyone is flunked. And I said, because I remember vividly, if these students were to take their best painting and go to the Royal Academy of the Arts for an entry exam in Belgium, in Antwerp, none of them will get through.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and he said, I know, but, you know, the accent is on this and on that and on that. I said, I know. The accent is on crit classes, which I think is the most ridiculous thing ever, and on basically the business aspect. Artists need to sell themselves. You need to sell them.
You have to.
The parents that say, like, if I have to pay for your studies, it's going to cost so much, you better make sure that you sell your paintings.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes about selling. And meanwhile, what happened to the art?
Right.
Because then you might as well start a cake shop.
Right.
Because, you know, and you probably sell a lot more than you will sell your paintings.
Yeah.
So that's the difference.
So, you know, one of the questions that I was asking myself earlier that I wanted to get to with you is, you have a lot of issues, and I do as well, with the way certain things go down in the art world, right? How do you facilitate any change? And here, this visit to this school is a perfect example, right? So the question is, in addition to being honest with this chair and saying, look, you know, none of these people would have passed the entrance exam at Royal Academy in Belgium. Do you feel like it was a good opportunity for you to sort of muscle your thoughts, your beliefs around and say, look, you know, you guys are really fucking this up big time. You need to do some serious rehaul, renovation of the way you're teaching your students. I mean, was that
right.
kind of the thing that went on? Or
this the man who was teaching this class, whom I know very well, and he's a very nice person, has no say in it.
Mm.
This is being dictated by the board.
Mm-hmm.
It's being dictated by the students because the students are paying for those studies.
Mm-hmm.
They're the customers. So they basically say what they're going to get.
Right.
It's as simple as that. It's not like the school system in Europe where you are told what to do. And if you can't do it, you flunk and you're out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to pay there.
Right.
You go and study. It's for free. So the only thing you buy is your materials, but you don't have to pay a tuition fee.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference. So as soon as you have a business model, a school is a business model, a hospital is a business model. Well, what kind of a society is that? And what do you think comes out of that?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's all very logical, but
yeah.
And this one person cannot do anything because it's in hand of the boards. The only thing that would happen is that the board would say, oh, since you have that opinion, goodbye and thank you. We need someone else.
Yeah.
And please rest assured, there will be some bozo who will be happy to take over that spot.
Right. You're describing, of course, you know, not that I need to spell it out, but I'm just going to, just in case I get some of it a little off, a world in which, at least if this school is any example, a world in which
mm-hmm.
it's all about politics and extroversion and playing the game and nothing about the work itself. So we're talking about an
Correct.
Art world in which there's a ton of crap work that has risen to the top because of the politics
yep.
of the way these students have mastered that aspect of the game.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's yeah. exactly it.
Right. Right.
You get better artists from outside, what they call outsider art, which I also think is such a demeaning term. But there are outsider artists are far more interesting than anything coming out of school.
Yeah, sure.
And I also have to add, when I came out of art school, I basically learned everything I needed to learn from my teacher, my professor, who took me in and basically let me share his studio, which basically comes down to like the system in the Middle Ages where you worked with the master and that was it. And then afterwards you flew away on your own. So that's where I learned most of what I had to know as an artist after I finished school. And because during school, I got the basics, and which was the whole ideology, of course. You are in school to assemble tools for your tool bag. You're not here to create something. We were not allowed to create our own paintings. You were there, a craft. And then of course, you were also taught art history and et cetera, et cetera. So your mind would be broadened to the arts, and you were confronted with the visual arts and with the performing arts, all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But when you left, you had a tool bag full of tools. And then you were able to start and create your own world.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore is what I'm saying, that that's when I started learning, because I was so lucky to be in the studio of my professor. And so that I could make work there, and he would talk and he would put music on that I never heard before, and I thought was fascinating, and he would show me things that I'd never seen before that I found fascinating. So that's where I learned the most.
Right. Certainly this painter that we were talking about a minute ago, who's
yes.
the ultimate introvert and is not
yes.
somebody who would do a good presentation of their work, you know, do a Q&A or what have you.
No.
Certainly these types of artists who are showing, you know, and out there with their work at least, They're in the a great minority, correct?
Right.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is absolutely correct. Right. Yes.
Another thing, sort of tangential to this way that the system is going, at least based on this one example of the art school disaster scenario that you described, is whether meritocracy exists in the art world anywhere. I mean, certainly with, I could see based on the example you were describing, you know, with these young artists, that there would be a lot of like mid to maybe emerging galleries showing a lot of work that had landed there because of the excellent political play of its artists, right? But when you but when you get to maybe a bigger stage, let's just say, I'm going to use an example in a second, but when you're talking about museums, contemporary museums, is there not a certain amount of meritocracy that gets those artists into shows? Not exclusively, for sure. And I'm going to use the example of Forever Now at MoMA, which, without getting into any detail, really, that was a show that received a lot of controversy. I think part of because, on one hand, it was really placating to the market, and I think and then to another extent, it was about connections. And of course, that expression, it's about connections, can be said about just about everything. But I guess the question I have now for you is, to what extent are connections and going back to that curator who, the unethical or whatever you want to call it, curator, the illogical curator, right, from early in the conversation, to what extent did those kinds of people and dynamics rule things from your perspective?
100%.
Wow. That's a big answer.
Not even 99.9.
Right.
100%.
Right. Okay. But if you are not operating that way, if you're operating through meritocracy and your own vision and not being swayed by who people know and so on and so forth, you're at least 0.1%, and there are other galleries like you, I would hope. So together, all of you maybe make up, 10%, maybe, to be generous?
That's very generous.
Too generous, right.
That is very generous. Yeah. I don't think I could come up with 1%. Mm-hmm. And because everything really, it pains me when I see young people who basically want to be a blue chip gallery, or that, you know, cater to the powers that be simply because they want to be in the game and they don't want to look like stupid or they don't want to look uncool. And it's so painful to me. And I don't know how, I mean, there's no beginning on how to tell them, like, you know, you should not, there's no reason for you to do this. You can do this. There's no point. There really is no point.
Because they won't listen?
They won't listen, no. No.
Well, why don't we do a little exercise here, Jimmy? Why don't you indulge yourself and me in what young artists or even slightly older artists like myself should do, you know, as opposed to the students in this class coming up to you before you reach their studios, giving you their business cards?
That's a good question. We are in the United States. So
alas.
I don't know of all of these schools in the United States. I know of the ones in New York, and I vaguely know of the one in LA, UCLA. And so that's basically my scope. I know of other schools, but I don't know enough about them. As far as New York City is concerned, I know it's a lost case. When you come here to study the arts, when you go out, you come out as like someone who needs to stand up for himself and needs to market themselves and blah, blah, blah. I used to get groups of students in the gallery who would come with the professor, grad students, And the professor would say, like, yeah, can they ask some questions? And of course they could. And when the question came, and it always came, was like, what do you suggest that we should do now that we graduate? And I said, get a job. And their face fell. And always, whenever I said that, the faces would fall. And eventually the teacher stopped coming because no one wants to hear that.
Wow.
And I said, don't misunderstand me. When I say get a job, I do not mean that you need to get a full-time job at McDonald's or whatever. No, you take a part-time job that covers your expenses, mm-hmm. your rent, your mm-hmm. electricity, all of that, so that you don't have to worry that you can't pay your bills at the end of the month. Because as soon as your artwork becomes the only way and the only means of income, you're no longer making your art, you're making a product.
Mm.
It cannot be that your art becomes a product.
Yeah,
that just can't happen. And no one took that seriously. They thought I was just like a bitter, mean person by saying, you know, you need to get a job. That's the first thing you do. And then don't even bother sending slides at that time, or discs or website links to a gallery, because they're not going to look.
Right.
And why are they not? They're not going to look not because they're mean. They're not going to look because they're busy representing and working for the artist they already have.
Mm-hmm.
The only way you can get into a gallery is if someone that the gallery knows brings you in and says, like, oh, look at this person's work. I think this is really great. Then they will look.
Yeah.
Because this is someone who is already connected to the gallery in one shape or way or another. And then you look at the work and you either like it or you don't, and that's the end of it. But that's also the only way. Because I used to, when I started, I felt like I need to be open to everyone. Everyone needs to be able to submit their art to the gallery. Oh my God, that was the biggest mistake of my life, because I had to basically hire someone to go through all the packages that came in every day,
mm-hmm.
and then to and send them back and write a letter with it. And find out that none of these people had even taken they didn't even make the effort to see what kind of art the gallery was showing.
Right, right. Sure.
So it was just like, I need a gallery. It didn't matter what the gallery was.
Mm-hmm.
So it was as if, you know, when I get, you know, photos of motor cars, races. I mean, what am I supposed to do with that? You know? And, but those were the things that literally happened. What
right,
am I supposed
right.
to do with that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So someone at school at least needs to tell these students that. But of course they're not going to say that because they don't want to hear that. And I'm sure if someone brings it up, they might get fired because they told them something they didn't want to hear.
Well, let me take those two pieces of advice or, you know, proclamations that you gave the students, which I think are really just, you know, postgraduate school 101, you know, no more than that. But let's go back to the students who gave you your business cards. Do you not think that they were taught, A, you should get a job while you're making your business card, and B, that you should not just randomly send your work to any gallery? Don't you think they know
no.
that? They don't know that either?
No.
Wow.
No.
So you're talking about a lot of miseducation going on.
It's we live in a world where business comes first. And, you know, it used to be art comes first. Andy Warhol said, art comes first, and then after that comes business art. And he thought that was a great idea. And that's exactly it. First there is art, and then there is business art.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the art is disappearing as fast as it can. You know, we have to like run after it with the speed of light to catch it again,
mm-hmm.
because we are stuck in business art.
Right. Okay. Okay. So in addition to adding to those first two big pieces of suggestions that you have, maybe let's say we're sophomores now and we're in intermediate art world behavior.
Right.
What kind of things are you going to teach in that class?
Oh, if I were a teacher?
Sure. Yeah, you gave us two pieces of wisdom. Give us a couple more, if you would.
If I were a teacher, I would just tell them to forget everything, and the only thing I would do was like present them with examples. I would show them, just like what I was taught, I would show them images of art periods. I would point things out. I would let them listen to music. I would show them performing arts. I would give them the entire package and talk with them about it, and then learn them, teach them craft. That's what I would do.
Okay, what about more the art world type activity as far as, okay, you're out of grad school, you're getting a job,
very simple. The thing I would say at that point is don't just go to any gallery. You look through all the galleries that you know of, and you look and you see which gallery, where would I fit?
Right.
Which is different from I would want to be with that gallery. That's not the same thing. You might very well want to be with that gallery, but that doesn't mean your work fits there.
Sure.
Because artists don't always recognize their own body of work.
Right.
They think it's a certain way, but it's not like that. And so you first, that's what you do. You find out, okay, which galleries show work in which my work would fit.
Right.
And when you found those, then you need to find out, okay, hopefully I come across someone who either is an artist in that gallery or works at that gallery or whatever, so I can be presented. If not, I just go to the openings at that gallery and talk to people. And in a way, then you will get into that gallery. But then you still have to be, you know, at least a bit of an extrovert to do that. Because mm-hmm. I, for example, would not have, that's not how I started. When I started, I basically wrote to the galleries that I liked and sent an example of my work. Back then, that was still something you could do because there weren't like 600 galleries.
Right.
And then you were called in or you weren't called in, and it was as simple as that.
Right.
And then I was not an easy artist because I also didn't want to attend my own openings because I really didn't. It was about the work, wasn't about me. So that was a difficult thing. I always did because, of course, the dealers wanted me present at the opening, and I didn't like that.
Right. Hmm. So you did not attend some of your openings?
No.
Huh.
No. I remember the last show at Gracie Mansion. She was in Chelsea, and at the corner of the street, there was a diner. And I said to her, well, if anyone really needs to speak to me, you walk them to the window of your gallery and you point to the diner and you'll say, that guy there eating the hot fudge sundae, that's the artist. So you can go over there and talk to him. And I literally sat there eating my hot fudge sundae, and I was very happy that they left me alone.
How? Just one sundae? How many sundaes?
No, I ate one sundae.
So you were in the diner for all of what, a half hour?
No, I sat there with that after I was done eating it. I just stayed there and sat at the terrace.
Wow. Huh. Well, you know, that's quite a shift from being the artist who not only doesn't attend his opening, but goes down the street and, you know, makes his face available, but hopes nobody comes, to running a gallery, you know, where obviously you have to do a lot of personal interaction. I guess here's a question. As a gallerist, let's just take the whole paradigm shift or change of your gallery to from being a what did you call it, a factory?
An assembly line
assembly
gallery.
Line, thank you. Yeah, from being an assembly line gallery to being more of a project gallery,
an
if you will.
Space. Yes,
yeah.
An
yeah.
event space.
Got
it's
it.
Not even a project. It's basically just shows that are up for 4 months, and then we do events during those 4 months.
Events.
And these events can be no matter what.
Okay, so even though you have downgraded or changed, if you prefer,
mm-hmm.
to this different
mm-hmm.
model, you, mm-hmm. in addition to being an artist working with artists, as you put it earlier, you're also mm-hmm. an artist or a gallerist who is working mm-hmm. with collectors and the public and so on. So did you, right. have you evolved your persona, your personality, and your behavior over the years to fit that mold, or what happened?
Oh, no, not at all. I always was a one-on-one person, and I still am. I'm during the openings, I'm in my office. Everyone who knows me knows that if you want to speak to Jimmy, he's in his office. I would not be up front with all the people. I have a director of the gallery whose job that is. I would just sit here and work, and if someone wanted to come and have a chat, they could. As far as collectors go, I would take them out to dinner, not 15 at a time, just one by one, mm-hmm. because I am good one by one. And I have a general rule that states never more than three people in a party.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's four people, then you get discussions between two people and two people. And
right.
I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't have enough time to waste. I mean, the clock is ticking. You get older and older and older, and that gets faster and faster and faster. Why would I spend my time talking to people that are not even listening, that are talking to someone else?
Sure.
I prefer to talk one-on-one, or, as I said, three maximum. Then at least you're talking with each other.
Yeah.
Everything else to me is a waste of time. That's great when you're young, you know, you should do all these things when you're young. But when you're older, no, sorry. I know exactly what I want.
That's great.
And I don't move one iota.
That's great.
And I haven't since the gallery. Since I have the gallery, I've never changed my persona. Mm-hmm. I was already old for being a dealer. So,
right.
And now I'm older. So on the contrary, I'm even worse than I was before.
You just gave me a little extra perspective and decision-making clarity, because I'm on the verge of setting up a special episode of the show in which we've been wrangling about who's going to be on in the conversation. And initially there was talk of three different people in addition to me. And the latest I was thinking is that it would just be two people and then me. And I think based on what you just said, that you just made that extra clear that's
yes,
the better dynamic. Yeah. 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 But regarding, you know, I really appreciate that you have figured things out and made things work for you, even though, you know, you have changed models. The question, though, is, let's just play devil's advocate for a second. For a gallery in, whether it's in New York or in Los Angeles or Chicago or London, et cetera, mm-hmm. to be a sustainable gallery, because I'm not going to use the word successful, because you've already dirtied that word from your description of it earlier. but to be a sustainable gallery, let's just say,
mm-hmm.
is that model applicable? In other words, do you know of other galleries where the gallerist is only in their office during openings, not going out and cavorting with the masses, and
no.
and only doing meetings with one or two people at a time, that kind of thing?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Bear, in the 80s, I know that from Gracie Mansion, it was like that in the 80s. You could get that in the 80s, but in the 80s, the East Village galleries, they were also all friends of each other, and there was no competition, there was no nothing. It was all for the sake of art, and it was all fun and very creative, and then, bang, everyone died, because there was the AIDS epidemic. And the ones that were left over, were basically business-oriented people who started the business model of the galleries.
Right.
Which at that time already existed, but not for contemporary galleries. It was, you know, more the Midtown galleries that, you know, had their stable of, European artists. But then all of a sudden that changed. And that's when the fun was taken out of it to begin with. And gradually it grew worse and worse and worse and worse and worse.
Yeah. Yeah. So you, with Envoy Enterprises Gallery, you have never done art fairs, is that correct?
No, that's not correct.
Okay.
I did I did an art fair in 2006 and 2007. And then I stopped because I went to the art fair because that was where the sales were being made. And I wanted my artist to make money. And at that point in time, that was true. But then it shifted where it became that all of a sudden there were no more sales. But collectors would still come by and say hello. And curators would come by and say hello. And the press would come and talk to you. Then the final stage, none of that happened. It was just people who would come by. Collectors were being like rushed through the fair by curators from museums. And they would just straight go to the blue chip galleries to the artists that were hot at the time.
Right.
And so did the press. So, and then I thought, like, why am I spending like more than $30,000 here to sit at a fair where no one even looks at my artists? Might as well spend that money and make a coffee table book and send that out to curators and collectors.
Sure.
And that benefits the artist more. So I stopped going.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, from the beginning, I hated art fairs because that is to say, from when I started the gallery, I hated art fairs because it's not the environment to look at art.
Right.
An art fair is the same as a car fair.
Right.
And I always said, like, you know what, if someone asks me, okay, here is a ticket for Hong Kong, and you can fly all expenses paid, and you can go either to the Hong Kong art fair or to the Hong Kong sex fair, what will you do? And I would say, I would go to the Hong Kong sex fair because at least it's less vulgar. And
right.
And I truly, truly mean that.
Uh-huh.
It's honest and it's open and it's less vulgar. In the 70s, I liked going to Fiat, for example, in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, there were only a few art fairs. There was Fiat, there was a Chicago art fair, and there was the Basel art fair, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Art Cologne. Those were, that was it. And then a little later, there was the fair Arco in Madrid, and that was about it. And that rhymed too. so I really liked Fiat because I got to see galleries from Timbuktu there, for example.
Mm-hmm.
How on earth would I ever get to Timbuktu and see what they were doing there? That was what was interesting about art fairs. There were places on earth where you would never go to that had a booth there.
Right.
But as soon as the art fair thing exploded and became a business, those Timbuktu galleries can't get into the fair anymore because of the political system. It's just all the blue chip galleries. And then those few that are recommended by the blue chip galleries, because they're indirectly actually also a little bit funded by them, and then funnel all these into, and that's it. Well, what happened then is that you go from one fair to the other, and it's all the same galleries. It's all the same art. What's the point? It's Starbucks. No matter where you go in the world, whether you go to Spain, whether you go to France, whether you go to Miami, whether you go to Basel, it's the same thing. It's also the same thing with museums. You used to have museums and they had their own identity. And now you go to a museum, oh, there's an Ai Weiwei show. I drive to Frankfurt, there's an Ai Weiwei show. I go to London, there's an Ai Weiwei show. And I'm like, what happened to, and then when I say that, I get told, yes, but those are traveling shows. Well, I have no problem with traveling shows, but is every show on earth traveling these days? Because all I see is the same thing everywhere. There were days where you had a museum that had a specific character. You would see specific art there. They would, for example, not do an Ai Weiwei show. But now it's all the same. Another example of how boring it all is,
mm-hmm.
and how the few are determining the whole art industry. Everything about it, from the bottom down to the top.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be in that. I don't want to be in that. That doesn't mean that I can't have a voice, and it doesn't mean I can do what I do. I will, and I am doing it, but it's on my terms. I don't want to play that game.
Right. What about, though, just to play, again, devil's advocate, you described going to these couple of art fairs because, you know, I think you said something like because you kind of needed to.
I keep
getting that sentiment now, you know, that uh-huh. many galleries, including, you know, emerging and barely mid-tier ones, need to go because that's where they make their sales, you know? So obviously you have a different model, mm-hmm. but I mean, isn't so much of the art world, the market art world anyway, drawn to that system because, well, for example, go ahead. I'm sorry.
The art fairs are a Ponzi scheme because I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
The last fair I did, during the VIP opening, I had a forklift in the middle of my booth. I had no lights. So everyone passed by my booth because bloody forklift took up the whole booth, and it was pitch dark in there. So I was fuming because during the opening, that's when you make most of your sales back then. And the next morning, I passed by a reputable LA gallery, and she says to me, "Jimmy, what's with the sour face?" And I said, "Well, you can be happy because you sold a $6 million sculpture to Tobey Maguire." And she said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Don't you read the stuff on your desk? Because, you know, at the fairs every morning, you know, that's the PR thing. They put the newspaper articles on the desk of all the things they did, the fair did for you by, you know, making sure that they wrote about you, that there are articles about the fair, that people will be coming." And so there was an article in the newspaper. And that at the VIP opening, Tobey Maguire had bought this sculpture from this gallery. And she said, No. She said, "I didn't sell anything. What are you talking about?" So I go over to her desk and I pointed at it. And she said, "Oh, that's not true." She said, "Because I didn't sell anything." And I was like, "Yeah, well, makes sense to me." They're lying. The art fairs lie. They actually come by your booth and ask you, "Have you sold something expensive?" I'm not kidding. "Have you sold something really expensive?" "No." "Have you sold anything?" "No." "Oh, okay." Then they run off because that they don't want to know. And so if they get, "No, I didn't sell anything," from every single booth, they can't do that. They can't write in the press like, "Oh, well, you know, our sales were very low this year." Because that, all they know very well, all galleries are waiting for that to happen so they don't have to come to the fair anymore. That's the problem.
Wow.
So I say to all these galleries, stay home. Because they're all saying, "Oh, you need to go. And then I say, "Okay, did you sell something?" "No." "Why, then why are you going?" "Well, because you need to be there. Because everyone else thinks that when you're there, you know, it's a prestige thing. And also, you know, you sell stuff." I said, "But it's all based on a lie. It's a Ponzi scheme. And you keep doing it. Why don't you just stay home? Spend that money on a book for your artists. Spend that money on the rent for your art, for your gallery if you're in New York. I mean, but don't go to the fair because you just said so. You're not selling anything there."
I hear you, Jimmy. Let's just maybe put a finer point on it, because what about a gallery that breaks even at, say, one of the smaller fairs at Miami or, you know, at San Francisco, one of these fairs in San Francisco recently, or the one that they do here at the Barker Hangar in Santa Monica in Los Angeles. Let's just say that a gallery who's come from out of town breaks even. The benefit, presumably, I'm not an expert on this, don't quiz me, but presumably the benefit is that they've maintained connections with their network, with their collectors, and so on, and they remain on the radar. I mean, that, speaking of logical, that does seem logical to me. Does it not seem logical to you?
that seemed that is logical. It seemed logical. That's how it was. That's no longer how it is. Because
right.
Now it's even so bad that if you let's say you do sell something, and I'm telling you, the grand majority does not sell. They're not going to say that to you, because which gallery will tell you, well, I didn't sell anything there? That makes their gallery sound bad. So no one is going to tell you that they didn't sell anything.
Mm-hmm.
So they're either going to lie, or they're going to say like, oh, we have several sales that are in the making, and it was really good. And here is this. If you don't have your credit card machine with you and swipe that card right away, those sales fall through. People that say, oh, I'm buying this, send me an invoice. Well, they fall through. No invoice. Do you really honestly believe that there's people that go like, oh, I like this artist, I like this gallery, I'm going to stay in touch? No.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they've seen it and it's gone. I have a very passionate collector, truly, truly passionate collector, who goes to all of the art fairs. So I asked him, how was Art Basel? Wasn't all that great. Oh, okay. Did you see anything that was like great? Yes, actually. I saw these artists that were like green paintings. And I think it was a gallery in Stockholm, but I'm not quite sure. but it was really great. This comes from someone who actually loves art,
right.
Who does not buy art for investment.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too much.
Mm-hmm.
It's all too much.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, you're not going to write down in your notebook, I like this artist from this gallery.
Right.
Because it's all so overwhelming.
Sure.
You do only one half of an aisle, and you're already like, okay, where's my Excedrin? Because you're already getting a splitting headache.
Right. Yeah.
So that's the reality. And I know that everyone would love for it to be different. I have no problem with that. As I said, I have no problem with blue chip galleries. I have no problem with art fairs. I think everything should exist and should be there. Everything should be available. Personally, for me personally, I don't want to have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know it's like a Ponzi scheme. It doesn't work. And they're basically bamboozling everyone. But you want to be bamboozled, be my guest. I have no problem with that.
Hey, I'm with you. Yeah. Go for it. Yeah, you and I could not be more on the same page when it comes to the art fair experience. I have done very few of them as a visitor over my years.
Right.
So I'm with you there. And just to clarify, you mentioned that, because I'm not aware of this, as you know, not surprisingly, but you mentioned that when somebody's interested in a piece at a booth, that gallery mm-hmm. better have their credit card machine, right? Because
yeah.
they need to make that sale right on the spot. So is
yes.
that the new norm
yeah.
as far as a sale at an art
oh,
fair?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, definitely.
Right. Okay.
I remember when I went to the fair in Paris, I actually wanted a machine that I could hang around my neck because I thought it was so repulsive, the whole thing. And I wanted to paint it gold and on a gold chain and hang it
right.
around my neck
right.
and that I could swipe the card.
Right.
Because at that time already, it was like you had to make it right there and then, because sending invoices, no way. And now it's even so bad. A colleague of mine said, well, I swiped the card, but they pulled the sale. So they declined the charge.
Hmm.
There you go. And there's nothing you can do.
Wow.
Meanwhile, let's say someone else came in your book and said, I want these fees. I know this sold. Yeah, right. It wasn't. And then you have the name of that person, and you write to that person, like, hey, guess what? The work is now available. You don't hear a word back because everything is of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a Twitter generation.
Right.
This is a Twitter society. It's like 15 minutes of fame. Are you kidding me? It's 15 seconds.
Right.
And that's it. Everything goes boom, 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 boom,
yeah, yeah.
real fast. And you either got in or you didn't.
You know, I feel like we would be remiss before we wrap things up. Early on, you described how you were an artist who was going to transition out of art for health reasons, and you couldn't do a museum, you said, because you talk too much, right? You would say too much, you say what's on your mind. I feel like as much as you have shared about what you think about the art world and its various pieces and parts, I feel like there's maybe a little bit more specific material that we haven't, you haven't shared. What comes to mind? Like what, or, I mean, I feel like you're probably, as outspoken as you are, you're probably too smart or too political to actually mention maybe some names, but I mean, what other kind of, what are some of your big gripes, if not with a particular gallery or particular artist, that come to mind just off the top of your head?
What are the big what?
Gripes. Gripe. Complaints.
Okay. Well, I have to be really honest. None, because I don't see it as such.
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe that everyone is entitled to do what they're supposed to do, and that's not a political statement or a very diplomatic statement, even though it comes across as such.
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe that. You need to do what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I was always told, like, oh, you have to go to the art fairs because it's important to go, because it's prestige, and if you don't belong to the group, and, you know, and you need to compete. And then I always replied, why would I need to compete? I do not feel the need to compete. I don't need to compete with David Zwirner. I don't need to compete with Larry Gagosian. I don't need to compete with Barbara Gladstone. I don't need to compete with Pace. I can go on. Why would I need to compete with them? The competition is fixed. So it's already fixed. There is no need for me to compete. Plus, they have clientele that I really, really do not want. I don't want these people.
Can you be more specific about these people, maybe?
What did you say?
I said, can you be more specific about these people as you described them?
These clientele? People being the very snobbish, entitled, rich people that come in through the door. Believe me, I get them once in a while, but they don't stay long. They come in and they take off their coat and they hand it over to me. those people.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that fund those galleries. I don't need those people. Carry your own coat.
Yeah.
You know, No.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't need to compete. I am my own thing. I do my own thing. Do you get outsider anxiety once in a while? Of course you do, because I'm only human. But at the same time, I'm stubborn enough to go like, well, this is what I believe in, and this is what I will keep doing.
Yeah. Do you have a sense this early on in your transition from more traditional gallery model to event/project model that your schedule will be different, you'll be happier, you'll be less annoyed or frustrated by the things that you complained about in your letter?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is going to be much like the East Village art scene was. It's going to be, by making it into an event space, it means you get a gathering of people together.
Yeah.
Those people together are automatically already going to have fun because it's not a stale thing. It's not a stale opening.
Right.
And the events can be anything. Can be someone's book launch, someone who wants to recite a couple of poems, and we're getting people in there. And I can have Gary Indiana in there and do a whole reading of his work. And that sort of event is what we're planning.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, the art is there and stays on the wall for 4 months. So it literally, the shows are opening on the 21st of September, the 21st of December, the 21st of March, and the 21st of June.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as simple as that. And those are the days that we start the new season, literally. And I am convinced that I will sell at least as much as I did before. But it is far less of a headache because I'm not in the assembly line gallery business anymore. And the artists understand this is, we are making a collaborative effort. And it's not just me, it's all of us. Envoy Enterprises was never the Jimmy Dams gallery. There was a reason for that. It's not about me, it was about us.
Right. That's a very important distinction, and I guess all galleries who use their names in the gallery title should keep that in mind, right?
Well, so that's up to them. I mean,
sure.
You know, I was told when I was naming my gallery, I was told, oh, don't do that, because collectors don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Collectors want galleries to have their name. They
mm-hmm.
need the name of the person who owns the gallery. And I said, well, how can you, that's my general point of view in life. No one does anything by themselves. I remember when President Obama said that, there was a whole backlash about the fact that he said, you don't do anything by yourself.
Right.
I'm sorry, he's right. You don't do anything by yourself.
Right.
If you have a factory, but you have no workers, you have no product, and you have no money. And so on and so forth. And if you don't have a supplier for your for whatever it is you're constructing, you also can't do anything. You're dependent on a whole bunch of people. We are all dependent on each other. So you don't do anything by yourself. And therefore, I said I wanted to be called Envoy Enterprises. And Envoy, there was a reason for that. It was because it's like envoy to the United Nations, the representative of a country to the United Nations. For me, it was a representative for the artists to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it was Envoy Enterprises. It was also not Envoy Gallery, because we didn't only show visual arts, we also showed performing arts. Because I truly believe in the homo universalis, meaning I literally all the arts combined, they inform each other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to pigeonhole it into just like, okay, I'm only showing painters and sculptors and drawers. No, I also want to include performers in that. And once in a while, I want to show a movie. I want to be able to do that. It needs to be a whole experience. That's why it was called Envoy Enterprises. That's what I did. And
right.
I also know people continue to ask me, well, but what are you? Are you a gallery, or are you a nonprofit? Because of course, if you showed performances, you had to be a nonprofit. Things like that, really. And
sure. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so one last thing, Jimmy. We're on August 16th as we speak, and
right.
you're in New York, so I can mm-hmm. practically hear through the phone line the Hamptons calling you. When are you going to be leaving the city?
I've been to the Hamptons one day in my life.
Oh, really?
Just one day, and that was for a good cause. It was for the artwork for the homeless, and that was it.
Wow. So you don't get out, do you not get out of town in August at all?
No, I always keep working, and the other thing is I never leave the island.
Wow.
Even all the things that are being done in Brooklyn are being done by people that work for me. They're not being done by me because I stay in Manhattan.
Wow. That's wild.
I know.
It reminds
Some
me
say,
of...
oh, you're a snob. And I go like, no.
No, it actually...
It's just I want to be able to walk everywhere I go.
Right. Yeah. You don't. It's nice not being a slave to the subway, isn't it?
Yes.
Of course, it's hard to appreciate it when you don't ever get on the subway. But in any case,
right.
It does just remind me of something that Fran Lebowitz said when asked, you know, if she was going out to the Hamptons or what have you. She said, no, I summer where I winter.
Yeah. Yeah. I love Fran Lebowitz.
Yeah.
He's also the one who said, like, you don't make $1 billion, you steal $1 billion.
Right.
And I actually said that without realizing it to one of my billionaire collectors.
Oops.
and I went like, well, he knows who I am. So
do you have a billionaire collector, Jimmy?
I told that, yeah, I said it to a collector, but by chance, because Fran Lebowitz happened to pass by while I was having lunch with a collector. And I said, oh, there, Fran and Lebowitz. And he said, oh, the photographer? I said, no, not Annie Lebowitz, Fran Lebowitz, the person from the Warhol Factory, the writer. And he goes, oh, I don't know that. I said, yes, you do. She's the one who said, you don't make $1 billion, you steal $1 billion. and then I saw his face drop, and I was like, oh. Oh no! What did I say?
Oops!
And then I was like, "Well, oops! at the same time, he knows I'm like more red than a tomato. So
right, yeah, got it. Well, Jimmy, you've been great to talk to. You know, thank you for taking the time and the extra long time. Thank you so much.
No, and thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
Absolutely. And we're out. Thank you so much again to Jimmy. Merci beaucoup. I hope you guys found that enlightening, inspiring, thought-provoking, etc. And do let us know what you think, please. Before we get on to the Kerry James Marshall essay, letter, screed, words of wisdom, I want to remind you, as we always do, that this is a listener-supported show. This show really does depend on you, the listener, to keep this show going. So thank you to those of you who have donated recently very much. Thank you very much to those of you who remain on Patreon and support the show ongoing. I hope you guys consider joining them. I still have some posters from Kate McQuillan, the last guest from episode 197, her Nighthouse poster that was an extension of the Nighthouse installation that she did. So I still have some of those posters. You can donate, let's say, $25 now plus shipping, and I will get you some bonus episodes if you want one of those posters. So if you're interested, drop a line. I'll hook you up. Okay, you can also, of course, Patreon, PayPal, both via theconversationpod.com, and you can leave a kind word on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play, wherever else we are. Bring more people to the show. You can recommend me to other podcasts, God willing, God forbid, so other audiences can learn about this show and me. And, of course, you can follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter, and you can become a fan on Facebook as well. You can engage wherever we are and certainly let us know what you thought of this episode. Okay, so I did go see the Kerry James Marshall retrospective that was here in Los Angeles at the Museum of Contemporary Art. It was at the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago before that. I know it was at a Metropolitan Museum, I believe, in New York. I don't know where it is now. It's probably still touring. Honestly, I enjoyed the show. I was not blown away by it. I know that's sacrilege because the comments that I have seen, so many people were blown away. I was not blown away. And, you know, that red painting, I have to say, that was pretty intense. I was fairly blown away by that. But as my expectations, I don't know what my expectations were, but let's just say that I was not blown away. I enjoyed it. I was kind of blown away by these comments, though, that I heard on another podcast, like I said. And so I'm going to read them. Bear with me. Hopefully you're driving, you're working in the studio, you are climbing up a mountain, and this will all fit in with what you're doing. Whether you are in grad school, undergrad, 20 years out of art school, whatever, hopefully this will be interesting to you. So it's an excerpt from his letter. It's going to be about 5 minutes, maybe four. When I left school, I felt, as you seem to, at the mercy of mysterious authorities I did not know and forces beyond my control. I had done some exercises and made a few things, but never felt I really learned anything. A hope and a prayer was all I really had to go on. There was nothing to look forward to, nothing to work toward. I was told, there's nothing you can do. Shut up and do your work. They'll let you know if you made the grade. That arrangement is unreliable and totally unacceptable. Never surrender your dreams to chance alone. Needless to say, I was angry and bitter after school. I felt there were important and concrete lessons to learn, but few teachers seem willing or able to pass the information on. At this point, I understand a thing or two. What I've learned since school gives me many reasons to be very particular about with whom I share this knowledge. Your letter provides no specific information about your identity. I have no idea who you are. The appeal seems genuine enough, though, so despite some reservations, I'll take a chance this once. You are barely 1 year out of art school, so what you might be experiencing are symptoms of withdrawal, not unlike those associated with mind-altering drugs. You've been on a bad trip, and it's going to take a little while to connect with reality. There are some things you can do, a few techniques that have worked for me to minimize the confusion and trauma. Art schools are sort of like crack dens. While inside, the environment feels cozy. Everything there seems remarkable because you're all smoking from the same pipe. In the heady, hazy fog of dialogue and critique, the smallest achievements are amplified. You begin to believe that things you make or do have value simply because you made or did them. Your friends are all supportive. They like your stuff. It is all very interesting, a nice piece. Be wary of this incessant chatter. In the sober world, the world outside, nobody really cares. Here you have to win attention, and the span allotted for recognition and celebrity is short and narrow indeed. Nevertheless, you did inhale lots of bullshit, and now it's time to blow it out and rehabilitate. Recognizing delusions is the first step toward recovery and, more likely than not, a successful career as an artist. Nobody with an undersized ego gets into this game. Everything is not okay. Always choose subjects that matter to you. The opponent is subjectivity. Artists are not magicians or shamans, prophets or seers. We make stuff. And the devices we use to, quote, transfigure the commonplace, unquote, are recognizable. Isolate, recontextualize, shift scale, shift material, invert, etc. The special status of art has more to do with its relationship to power and money than with any inherent attribute. So now I'm skipping ahead about a page. If you are black, you really are coming from behind. As the Japanese asserted, oetsuke, closing the distance, and oekose, overtaking white folks, thereby weakening white dominance, is the challenge we face. It took a while, but I finally realized we are not all in this race together. If your recognition depends on the kindness and generosity of others, you are in a world of trouble, buddy. There's a competition going on. The art world is not a level playing field. If you're going to play, though, you've got to play for keeps and play to win. An artist is a business professional like any other. It takes tremendous resources and a good accountant to maintain a, he uses the P word, to maintain a P word long enough to evolve and stabilize. Only longevity allows a truly meaningful and realistic assessment of one's achievement. There are no workable timetables for career success, so take your time. The urgency that drives you, that propels you into the studio every day, should be the desire to see figures as yet unrealized. If this is where your heart is, integrity will not be an issue. Sincerely, Kerry James Marshall, Chicago. So there you go. How many minutes was that? Let's see. Okay, yeah, it was about four or five minutes. I hope you guys enjoyed that, found it inspiring, thoughtful, thought-provoking, just like Jimmy Dan's. And I thank you guys for being here, for listening, for sticking it out with this show, and for supporting it. And I will talk to you in a couple weeks. Do let us know what you think, and I'll talk to you then. Ciao for now.